short term and transient. But I think as a coach, recognizing that people make choices because they make sense for them and under some set of circumstances. And learning that is key to helping them build other skills that can solve those problems.
Hello, hello, hello again, ladies and gentlemen. I am your host, Paul Wenzel, and welcome back to the Uncharted Performance Podcast. We are closing in on a very special number, episode 100, and we have some very, very exciting news coming up in a few short weeks. But before we get to that, we are now at episode 98, and we have the awesome, very awesome Brian St. Pierre with us. He comes extremely highly recommended from John Berardi. If you guys are not familiar with that name, it is becoming quickly the most recognizable name in nutrition because John is the head of Precision Nutrition, one of the most reputable sources of nutrition coaching and certification around, and one of the first individuals that Brian quickly mentioned when we were trying to set up this conversation, or just a conversation on nutrition, excuse the sirens in the back, was Brian's name, and he comes very highly recommended by John. And jokingly, and especially if you are in the fitness strength training world, nutrition might be as hotly debated topic among individuals as politics and religion in regular circles. It is one of the topics that can bring out the the worst and the best in people very, very quickly. A little bit about Brian. He is definitely renowned for his expertise in performance and nutrition. He is a registered dietitian with a master's in food science and human nutrition, with a very long list of credentials, and including publications, written 5 books under his belt. He's also worked with pro sports teams like the Spurs, San Antonio Spurs, and my local team, the Cleveland Browns, trust him for his nutrition consultation. But first and foremost, Brian is, as we get into the conversation, a precision nutrition coach, helping individuals of all ages and backgrounds achieve and help achieve their goals and feel better than they are right now. We do get into Brian's background, kind of his early influences, and what really the individuals that really helped him get to where he is at now. We discuss a number of very very interesting topics. Some are fantastic reminders. Other issues we really break down. Those include kind of interpersonal variability. The beautiful idea of nutrition really needs to be as complex as it needs to be. How you eat, how we eat, what we eat, meal prep and planning, stress management, the mindset. Really identifying common denominators across the different diet quote-unquote approaches, and there are, as I mentioned, millions of them, and they are very highly debated, especially if you are a diehard of one. You will believe that your particular diet approach might be the best one, but what Brian does is really deciphers through all of them and really picks out the common themes, including nutritional awareness, food quality, nutrition deficiencies, and regular exercise. No surprise there. We also go over, you know, intentional daily practices and what kind of fundamental skills we need to develop to get to where we need to be with our nutrition, setting realistic goals and having appropriate expectations, really understanding why are people doing certain things. And also, you know, the idea and the different aspects that set good coaches and great coaches apart, and not just nutrition coaches, but all coaches in general. We also covered kind of the continuum of nutrition, dabble with performance and recovery, as well as trying to debunk some myths with some of our favorite macros, those being carbs and fats. So with that said, we do get into nutrition at length, as I mentioned, but I think this is the conversation that we should all have, be it your paleo, your vegan, vegetarian, you count your macros, you do whatever you want. Brian is a fantastic resource, along with Precision Nutrition, that provides us very, very good practical guidance in what we should be doing with our nutrition, if it's either for health or for performance. So without further ado, ladies and gents, I present to you the quote-unquote future, or a part of the future of the nutrition conversation and the fast-growing precision nutrition. And definitely check out the show notes. We do have links to precision nutrition and their pro coach certifications. My wife is a precision nutrition certified coach, and it has been a very valuable asset in her toolkit. So I want to repeat that again without further ado this time for sure. Ladies and gents, this is Brian St. Pierre. Brian, welcome to Uncharted Performance Podcast. How are you doing, sir?
I am excellent, man. Thank you for having me.
You got it. Thank you for taking the time. I am actually going to start off with some of your credentials that will lead us into our first question. And I hope I get most of them, but you are the Director of Performance Nutrition at Precision Nutrition. You are a certified sports nutritionist through the International Society of Sports Nutritionists Certified. Strength and conditioning specialist through NSCA, master's degree in human nutrition and dietetics, and the first intern for Eric Cressy, and the first ever employee for Eric Cressy, which is very cool. Out of those that I just mentioned, which title do you hold most dear?
Yeah, I love that question. I don't think I've ever been asked it.
Oh, perfect, nice.
I would say, I hold most dear. Well, I think it's probably a two-part answer. Like, okay. I always loved the story of being like the first employee of Cressy Sports Performance, and the first, possibly second intern. Kind of depends, I guess, how you define an intern.
Uh-huh.
But that was just, you know, a springboard to my career, and just an amazing experience to be there when Cressy Performance was like tiny, and to see what it's become today. So that was really cool. But on the flip side, it's the same kind of story with PN. Like, being the Director of Performance Nutrition at PN, I mean, I've been following JB's work since I was in college, right? He's mm-hmm. a big reason why I switched from engineering into nutrition. So to go from working for Eric to then working for JB and now being such an integral part of PN is pretty humbling in the grand scheme of things. You know, a lot of it was like just, or seems like this way. It was right place, right time. You know, and so I'd say those two things. I mean, if you ask my dad what he thought would be most important, he would say being a registered dietitian.
Okay.
Right, my parents really wanted me to get that designation, so that I always had, like, in their mind, a fallback option to a real job, working at a hospital or something. And they've come to appreciate, you know, where I've come and what I do now. But when I first told them I was going to intern for free at Cressy Sports Performance after getting my my degree, they weren't quite on board. We'll just put it that way.
And I think you're actually pretty humble in your, I guess, answer as well, because as for those that know Eric Cressy and obviously PN, the leading kind of resources and experts in their respective fields. So congratulations on both accomplishments. You did mention, actually, what I wanted to get to next is you did dabble in engineering somewhat. And have you taken anything away from those studies that you apply now or have applied to your pursuits in health and fitness and nutrition?
Yeah, Yeah, it's a great question. Right, I was actually an engineering major for 3 years before switching to nutrition. I did computer engineering and didn't like that, and switched to mechanical engineering, and ultimately decided that nutrition was where I was better suited, fit my passions. But in terms of what I've taken from it, I've actually taken a lot. I mean, really, when you get down to it, the essence of engineering is problem solving, right? So, I mean, I can think back to some of my, less than fond memories of taking tests in engineering. And I remember some of my thermodynamics tests where, I mean, learning about the laws of thermodynamics, right, which apply to systems just like humans. So we really learn how that all really works. So it makes me really appreciate and I think have a deep understanding of how our metabolism functions. So that's a big part of it. But I would have 2 hours to solve three problems. Right, so you'd have just these three mathematical problems, and you'd have 2 hours to work your way through them. And because it took so many steps and formulas, and really what you could get the answer completely wrong because you could make one small mathematical error along the way. But what they were really looking for was how you thought through the problem. How are you attacking it? Right? What areas are you looking for? What variables are you considering? What are you not considering, and why? And so I think that can be really helpful as a nutrition coach to kind of have like that dispassionate or agnostic kind of problem solving, right? Not coming in with a lot of preconceived notions and biases. I mean, we all have some. We're human, right? We all have some implicit biases. There's no way around that. No one's truly fully objective. But being trained in engineering helps you be more objective or as objective as possible. And I think kind of viewing things a little bit dispassionately and not coming into it with like, oh, I gotta, this person's just gonna need low carb because I've seen it work so well for myself or so well for a few of my clients. So this person's gonna need to be plant-based because we know that that's, the best or whatever. You can put any name in there. So I think what really helps is it really gives you the tools to kind of take stock, look at some of the variables, find the most important ones, or triage what you think are the most important ones, and then systematically tackle them one by one.
Got it. And I think it's a perfect segue into the conversation. But before we get into like the meaty and gritty stuff about nutrition and eating right, for both health, wellness, and as well as sports performance, there's a beautifully written blog or article by JB John Berardi about you, and the scary coach T-shirt. And we'll link this up for those that haven't read it. But I guess my quick question is, because you don't seem like a scary guy, but do you still wear that shirt, and why did you start wearing it in the first place?
It's a great question. To answer your first part, no, I don't still wear it because it would be like 10 years old, and it was decidedly worn. Where it actually came from was when I worked at Cressy Sports Performance. We had basically at first there were three coaches, right? There was me, there was Eric, and there was Tony Gentilcore. Anybody who knows Tony Gentilcore knows that Tony's like fun-loving, goofy, got an eccentric sense of humor. He's not what you would consider like the tough love kind of coach, right? Eric was somewhere in between, and so I kind of filled the role of not being like a hard ass, because I think people respected how I approached it, but you weren't going to, pull any BS past me, basically. We coached a lot of high school athletes, right? So high school athletes are notorious for what? Oh, my dog ate my homework. Those kind of things, trying to skirt the rules or, whatever the case might be. So I was known for, in a fun way, keeping people accountable, keeping people on point, even our adult clients. And it was actually an adult client who made that shirt for me. So she actually had it created not too long before I left Cressy Sports Performance because she knew I was going to be leaving. And she always felt like when I was around is when she would be like, okay, no, I got to be on point. I got to make sure I'm getting my training. Whereas other times she felt like she could kind of, talk a little bit more, just kind of stretch it out a little bit. So yeah, it wasn't that I was truly scary, but that I made her feel like, all right, I got to get my stuff done. I've got to be on point. Brian's watching me. My form's got to be good. So it was just stuff like that. I mean, it was all in good fun. And I think part of it was also we'd put up like polls when we worked there. Before people would leave, we'd have like a poll. And like, if we had a Cressy Performance like barroom brawl, who would win between like me, Eric, Tony, Pete, like the business guy, and whoever was interning at the time? And much to Eric's chagrin, I got like 90% of the votes, right? So I think that was all just kind of rolled into it. I have like a contact sport background, playing rugby and hockey and lacrosse, and so people would tease Eric because he played soccer and tennis, and so and plus it just they did it because it got under his skin. It was all in good fun. So it was all just kind of rolled into to one kind of piece of it all. But it was a good time. I missed that time. I missed that work.
When you played sports before you kind of pursued your path in sports training and nutrition, did you think about nutrition at all? Was it a part of your, when you were playing hockey, rugby, and lacrosse, was that a big part of your athletic endeavor?
As I got older,
Okay.
absolutely. I was a very average athlete, right? I wasn't like going to be playing professionally anywhere. I wasn't even really going to be playing in college anywhere. So I was okay for high school, for Maine high school athletics. I did fine. I played varsity, but that was really the extent of it. So for me to kind of have an edge, I started to train like between my freshman and sophomore year. As I got older, started to focus more on the nutrition component as another way to improve my training, improve my athletic performance, gain some size. I'm not an overly large guy. I'm 5'10", almost 5'10" and a half, right? So when you're playing contact sports, like, and you're not 6'2", having some extra mass can be really valuable. So, I was really focused on that. So yeah, I think part of it was, I've told this story before, but I think it's just really valuable from my perspective. When I was younger, I was probably in like eighth grade. I'd worked out with my dad a lot when he was younger, and I was really young. I'm the oldest of three. And he was used to go to the gym, and then as he had more kids and had two businesses, like that just slowly kind of withered away. And then, but he gained like 20 or 30 pounds over that time. So by the time I was in eighth grade, he decided he was going to start exercising again. My sisters had gotten older, and he just changed his eating, started exercising, and lost all that weight, and has kept it off ever since. That was 20 over 20 years ago. And he never really like talked about it, but I was old enough to see it and be aware of it, and so that just really kind of stuck with me, and I think kind of inspired me to be more in tune with my fitness and my nutrition. And not always in the best ways when you're that old, because I think you kind of go to some extremes, but you learn from those mistakes. So I think, yeah, I mean, that was a key part of competing at a high level for me. I needed to incorporate those things because I wasn't going to be the kid who just stepped on the field and dominated.
Speaking of mistakes, and these we can take this a little bit further out. This doesn't necessarily have to be during high school, but maybe a little further on in terms of not just your personal training, but also coaching. What are some, I guess, the more visible to you personally, when you reflect on things, mistakes that you've maybe done, but that you've learned from and applied?
No, honestly, you learn best from your own mistakes, right? I mean, it's you only learn so much from your successes, and I think that can sometimes hide mistakes you are making. So, mistakes are often the best teachers. So, in my experience, I would say, for me, it was majoring in the minor. Like, I was really tied into like super specific nutrient timing protocols, eating like 8 times a day. It's got to be, separating my carbs and my fats. So it wasn't, I was doing all these complex things, which were fine. So I wouldn't even say they were mistakes because I had more advanced goals, right? I was someone trying to push the envelope. I was 22 years old and had no other real responsibilities, right? I didn't have kids. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a house. I didn't own a car. So you don't have, I was able to build my life, and my schedule around my training and my nutrition. So I don't even know if I'd call them mistakes so much as
Experiments.
experiments. Exactly. Yeah, that's a great word. And so I did all of these things, and obviously they worked. I got into good shape. I became really strong. I built a lot of muscle. But then as my life circumstances changed, but then the problem, actually, the so the mistake would be I started to apply that to other people. I had friends or teammates who'd want me to help them, and I would try to have them do what I did, not recognizing that I was really far progressed along the spectrum, right? Like I didn't start there. I first started in high school with like very, very just kind of stumbling along and feeling my way and making some changes. But I started them all the way at the end of the path where I was. And then that just failed miserably because they couldn't stick to it because they didn't have the fundamental skills in place, right? They hadn't built this system or this approach systematically over time like I had. So I just tried to give it to them all at once, and it would be like they'd follow it for 2 days and they just couldn't stick to it. Because again, they didn't have those underlying fundamental skills in place. And so I think that was probably the biggest mistake for me was not recognizing interpersonal variability, right? And how much what I was doing didn't necessarily apply to what someone who had very different goals was doing. Because I just didn't know at the time. I was young, I was inexperienced. So I think I would probably call that, the biggest mistake. And then as my life circumstances changed and as I gained more experience working with clients and as I read more, you discover that you only need to make nutrition as complicated as it needs to be, not as complicated as it can be. So for people who have more moderate goals or just taking their first steps, we can keep things really simple and just make like big rock fundamental changes and not worry about the minutia. And then we only worry about the minutia as we progress down the chain, right? As they're making more and more progress, they're building fundamental skills and becoming having that solid foundation. And if they want to keep pushing the envelope, okay, then we make things more complicated. But I would say that was probably the biggest learning experience for me was the more complexity you provide, the harder it is for people to be consistent. And we know that consistency is the number one thing for continued progress.
What are some of those fundamental skills that you mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a few, but I would say, some of the biggest ones would be like how you're eating, right? This is one of the things we start with right away with our own coaching clients is like eating slowly and mindfully, right? Paying attention to like your actual internal cues of appetite and satiation or satisfaction or fullness, right? A lot of times people eat because they're bored or they're stressed or this is just the time they normally eat, or it's a social event. And it's okay to do that, but it's to do it intentionally or with an informed decision where you know you're doing it because I'm indulging because it's going to make me feel better right now, and I'm okay with the consequences. So it's just getting people to pay attention to why they're eating and then how they're eating it slowly, right? Enjoying and savoring the meal, and then paying attention to your actual satisfaction and be like, wow, I feel satisfied, not still hungry, even though there still might be food on my plate. Too often we actually eat until the plate is cleared, regardless of how full we actually felt. So we work on that fundamental skill first and foremost with a lot of people. Then, of course, the what you're eating, right? And how much you're eating, working on whole, minimally processed foods, a mix of lean proteins, veggies, quality carbs, and healthy fats. And people get really tied up into like, how many carbs or how many fats to have. And quite honestly, that's based on personal preference and how it's working for. I would say protein and veggies are kind of like your two big rocks there, and then you can adjust carbs and fats to suit your own personal needs and preferences. After that, I mean, yeah, you get into like meal prep and planning skills, right? Those are really important for actually keeping you on track. I was giving those clients those fancy meal plans where they're eating 8 times a day, and they didn't have the fundamental meal prep and planning skills to actually enact that, right? So I did because I had built them up over time, but then I didn't recognize that when I was giving it to those clients. We talked about mistakes we've made. So those are all some fundamental skills that are critically important for anybody. Then you get into like sleep quality and quantity, right? Stress management and stress resilience. Those are kind of like your big levers. And of course, and there's movement and mindset and some other pieces, but just in terms of nutrition and lifestyle, those are the big ones right there.
So we got about five or six. Okay, perfect. So I think we might get a little deeper in one or two of these. But this is the worst question I'm going to ask probably during this conversation.
Looking forward to it.
So we're going to preface that. But you are an expert. So I'm going to ask it. But since there's no quote unquote healthiest diet out there, right, that everybody agrees on, it's like one of the most debated topics of all time is religion, politics, and a healthy diet, right? So
You're not too far off, right?
so we'll try to tackle one of those. But in your experience and from what you've learned, what are the general components of a healthy diet? And are those some of the are those that you just mentioned, some of those?
Yeah, I would say those are probably the majority of them, right? When you look at all the varying intakes that people champion and find success with, right? That sometimes seem completely contradictory to each other. You look at something like, if you've seen like Forks Over Knives or something like that, where you learn about the approaches of like Dr. Ornish or Esselstyn or what John McDougall, where they have these super low fat, really high carb intakes, right? Less than 10% of calories from fat. And they see tremendous success with some of their clients and patients. And then on the flip side, you have people who practice like a ketogenic diet where they're getting 75 or 80% of their calories from fat. And you see people having tremendous athletic success or losing tons of body weight and improving all of their health markers. Right? And there's research supporting some of this too. Like, how can both of those things be true? Right? They can't both be the best when they both seemingly work. And then you've also got other vegetarian approaches or zone diet or the Mediterranean diet, which is much more like 40% fat and 40% carbs. That kind of just blows right in the middle, right? Between the high carb, low fat, and low high fat, low carb, and they all seem to work. I mean, to varying degrees or with different people, but you can find research trials that show this worked for all of these health markers, right? All kinds of stuff: body weight, mood, cardiovascular markers, cancer markers. All these things improve. So when you really take a big picture look at the research, and you kind of take a step back, it's like, okay, well then what? What's the common denominator, or what are the common denominators, right, across all of these approaches? What are the things they recommend or they all tell you to do, right? What can we find? What commonalities can we find across all of them that might explain the benefits, regardless, or the majority of the benefits, regardless of whether you're eating a lot of carbs or a lot of fats or something in between? So I would say, first and foremost, what you see is they raise like nutrition awareness, and people pay more attention to their intake, right? And that's kind of like what I talked about, that first skill of why you're eating and how you're eating it, just getting people to be more mindful of their intake, right? It's just like getting people to start taking a food log. Oftentimes you see their nutrition improves just because they have to be writing it down, because they're now more aware of their intake, and it's not just something that's happening while they're doing other things. So they raise nutrition awareness to get people to be more mindful and to pay more attention. They focus on food quality, right? No diet, for the most part, is telling you, no intelligent diet is, for the long term, isn't telling you to eat a lot of junk food or highly processed foods, right? They're all focusing on minimally processed, fresh, whole foods. Some have more animals, some have more plants, some have a nice mix of the two, some have more fats, some have less. That seems less important, at least broadly. On an individual basis, it can be very important. But broadly, across the population, what seems to be most important is eating the vast majority of your intake from minimally processed whole foods, right? Making sure you're meeting your protein needs, getting in lots of fresh veggies and fruits, quality carbs, sorry, from things like legumes or fruits or potatoes, whole grains. I mean, some of those things, excuse me, something stuck in my throat.
You're fine.
So the exact sources don't seem to be as important as just getting those quality intakes. Same idea with like the third step. They kind of help to ensure you're not suffering from any overt nutritional deficiencies, or even like some subclinical ones, right? So you're making sure you're getting enough water, because most of them are emphasizing ensure you get enough low calorie fluids, right? Because again, you're getting minimally processed whole foods, which isn't going to include things like soda and juices. So they're getting plenty of water. Since they're full of minimally processed whole foods, you're getting a lot of vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients, right? They're usually emphasizing quality fats. So even if it's a low fat diet, the fats they're suggesting you eat are usually essential ones, things you need to make sure you're getting enough of, particularly things like omega-3s. Most of them are really emphasizing you're getting plenty of quality protein for muscle mass retention, for immune function, for cellular detoxification. I mean, you need protein for a lot of things. For satiety, we know protein is the most satiating macronutrient, right? It's going to help keep you fullest the longest, so you don't feel as hungry even when you're eating less. They help to control appetite and food intake, right? So with all those things I just kind of outlined, all the value and attributes of having mostly minimally processed whole foods, they tend to increase satiety, decrease calorie intake, without making you feel hungrier. And you're also displacing a lot of those highly processed, what we would call hyper palatable and hyper rewarding foods, foods that actually overstimulate your appetite, tend to desensitize your brain to your satiation and satiety mechanisms, so you tend to overeat them without even realizing it. They also tend to promote regular exercise, right?
Mm.
So you look at some of those low-fat programs I talked about, and that's where it's tricky with some of the research on them. They're not just looking at diet. They're also emphasizing lifestyle modifications like stress and sleep and exercise. And most of those other ones are as well. They're suggesting or recommending to get in a mix of activities that you enjoy, resistance training, cardiovascular training, yoga, what have you. So there are some common, you know, some really important or consistent denominators among all of those successful approaches. And I think that's really valuable to know, because it can be really easy to become like a dietary zealot, right? Like, oh, this keto worked so well for me. I have to spread the gospel. I have to spread the word. Everyone needs to follow this. People need to know. But we often fail to recognize, like, that not everyone else is going to respond the same way. But if you start really looking around and paying attention, you'll see that there's lots of us out there who are become dietary zealots. But then if you think about it, how can all of these people have success and be such diehard fans from seemingly drastically different approaches? And it's because they're not as different as they appear on the surface.
Yeah, and as a vegan myself, I would say that's the wrong answer, but that's just I'm obviously joking. No, but very, very well stated. And I think having an open mind is one of the keys to going through this journey. But for somebody that's new, somebody that's just kind of coming in, you know, fresh off the street, hearing all this can be somewhat overwhelming at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
It's great information, very valuable, but it can be also very overwhelming.
Right. So what do I actually do? If they all work, what do I do?
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm coming to you, Brian. Where do we start? How do I make this, you know, manageable?
Mm-hmm. Well, so in our view, the way to work on it is to build fundamental skills through intentional daily practice, right? So the exact ways you apply those skills, we kind of leave up to you in a sense. I mean, we give you direction,
mm-hmm.
but whether you're getting your proteins from animals or plants is up to you. We just share what those good sources are. Whether you're getting veggies from, you know, cruciferous vegetables or carrots or onions or a mix of everything, that's kind of your jam, man. There's no – the best vegetable is one you eat most consistently, right? Too often you hear the best vegetable is broccoli or, you know, kale or whatever the superfood of the day is. So in reality, what we try to teach is, okay, these are the fundamental skills you need to work on, right? So we start with the appetite and hunger cues and listening to those internal mechanisms. So getting people to eat slowly and mindfully and to stop once satisfied, to kind of learn to tune in to what their body is often trying to tell them, but they've never learned how to use those approaches because we, as a society, we eat based on external cues. How much is on my plate? Okay, I'm just going to eat that, right? How many things have I given at a restaurant? We have bigger plates today. The list can go on and on. So getting people to pay attention to those internal cues is kind of our first step. And then we're going to work on like protein, veggies, carbs, and fats. But the exact amounts, we don't dictate to people. We might give guidelines. We teach hand-sized portions, as I'm sure you're aware, like palms for protein, mm-hmm. fists for veggies, handfuls for carbs, and thumbs for fats. But we try to straddle the line of being prescriptive, like, hey, you want to make sure you're getting in like a, you know, palm or two of protein at every meal or a fist or two of veggies at every meal. But the goal isn't to like constantly use your hands forever. It's to help people ballpark their portion sizes, because humans are notorious at underestimating how much we eat, right? Research shows we might underestimate by up to 50% pretty regularly. So it's just a skill we think can be really helpful to rein that in, to make sure we're actually consuming portion sizes more appropriate for our needs. But we don't necessarily want people measuring even with their hands for forever. I mean, it can be really helpful. Ideally, you're just going to be paying attention to your internal cues and hunger and appetite cues for the most part long term. So those are kind of like the fundamental skills through intentional daily practice, but exactly how you implement them, whether it's via, plants for protein like you might eat, or a mix of animals and plants like I might eat. We leave it up to the personal preference of the client. We just give direction on how to do it based on whatever direction you want to experiment with.
Got it. Is there something as such as a bad goal to have?
Maybe not bad. I would probably say unrealistic.
Okay.
Right? So sometimes you might have a client who comes to you and wants to lose, 20 pounds in a month. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's technically possible through intense like water manipulation and carb manipulation strategies, but it's not going to be fat loss, right? So that's probably a quote unquote bad goal if you want to kind of go that route. But it's an unrealistic goal from what we actually know about human physiology and possible rates of fat loss, right? So that's one of the things we try to set from the beginning with clients is appropriate expectations. Mm-hmm. So if your goal is to lose body weight, what the research pretty consistently shows is aiming for about 0.5% to 1% of your body weight per week is a consistent, reasonable rate of loss that helps maintain lean mass and performance, immune function, right? Doesn't disrupt sleep and recovery, but you lose an appreciable amount of fat over time. Now, it's not going to happen every week. Now, as you know, weight loss is not linear. Fat loss is not linear. So it's not like this perfect 0.5% to 1%. Things fluctuate, but that trend over time would be about 0.5% to 1%. So if you're 200 pounds, that would be 1 to 2 pounds a week, right? Whereas if you're smaller, it's going to be less. If you're larger, it could be more on an absolute basis. And same thing for weight gain. It depends on how advanced you are. The more advanced you are, the slower that gain's going to be. And we have guidelines, for that as well. So I think it's really important to have an appropriate expectation from the outset, like mm-hmm. what's reasonable and realistic. Because it's quite often I work with, we train lots of other coaches and lots of other professionals to do nutrition coaching. And they'll come to us and be like, oh, I've got a client who's, lost whatever, 15 pounds mm-hmm. in 8 weeks and is, really frustrated. And it's like, holy smoke, 15 pounds in 8 weeks. That's incredible, mm-hmm. right? If you extrapolate that out, that's what? 90 pounds in a year, thereabouts. Like that would be like losing a whole person.
Yeah, you'll be gone in a couple of years.
right. But oftentimes people, I think, as clients, it's so easy to constantly be looking at the horizon, right? How far you still have to go. So it can be really valuable to take stock and reflect on how far you've already come, right? To turn around. So often we're on like this a path or this journey or whatever framework you want to use, mm-hmm. without getting too, woo. Getting people to like turn around and realize like, holy smokes, like I started way back there.
How far you've come, yeah.
And how I'm all the way here. I've already lost 15 pounds and 4 inches off my waist and I've, gotten stronger. I'm getting better sleep. I have more energy. Like shit, man, that's awesome. Like that is that is amazing progress. And I think it's really valuable as a coach and as just a client or a person to recognize that and appreciate that, because it can actually help people stay more consistent and stay on track rather than always focusing on, well, what's next or how much further I still have to go. So that's a key piece right there too.
Awesome. And speaking of coaching, what based on your experience and yourself as a coach, what are the qualities that make a good coach?
There are many, but I would say uh-huh. some of the biggest ones, to be client-centered. So that would be active listening, right? Not just jumping to solve problems, but actually looking to understand the actual issue first, like getting mm-hmm. deep understanding, getting to know your client's values and priorities and how that kind of fits into the actions that they're taking. Because so often it can be like, oh, why? Well, why are they doing X, Y, and Z? And the reason is because it's either solving a problem for them or it makes sense for them, at least right now. It may not be a good solution for their long-term goals, but it might make sense for a short-term benefit, right? Oh, why are they, stopping at Subway after work? Or it could be anything. And mm-hmm. having this muffin or this extra latte, because it's solving a problem. It's maybe alleviating some stress or some tension. Or, why are they having 3 drinks instead of one? Well, it's probably providing some kind of benefit. Short-term and transient. But I think as a coach, recognizing that people make choices because they make sense for them and under some set of circumstances. And learning that is key to helping them build other skills that can solve those problems, right? So other stress management or stress resilience skills that can then make it much easier to now decrease their coffee drinking or decrease their alcohol consumption or decrease their comfort food consumption that they've been turning to help solve that problem. So as a coach, active listening, truly getting to understand your client's deeper values and priorities, learning to use Crucial Conversations. That's a great book. I highly recommend Crucial Conversations. So it teaches you basically, oftentimes we think, okay, well, I got to just, show some tough love on this client. And there can be a time and a place for that. But really, what you need to work on is having an open, honest, and transparent conversation where you're not a doormat, but you're not a jerk either. Right? So kind of straddling that middle line of holding people accountable, but doing so in a compassionate way. Because it can be really easy to be flip or dismissive or mean, right? Which isn't going to get you long-term clients. But it's also not going to benefit you to just constantly be run over or accept every excuse under the book or just, be that proverbial doormat. That's not going to help your clients, right? And it's going to make you feel terrible. So that's a key piece to it. So Crucial Conversations, being client-centered. Just learning to ask the right questions. And in many cases, that's, working on like motivational interviewing skills. There's a great book called Motivational Interviewing and Nutrition and Fitness that really kind of gets you out of the textbook version of it and it's more applicable for our field that I think can be really helpful. Or there's a great book called Conscious Coaching by Brett Bartholomew. Same kind of idea, getting you to ask better questions so then you can understand clients better and then you can work together, collaborate. To come up with a skill building plan, right? To work on intentional practices to build skills to reach their goals.
Awesome. Thank you for sharing. Now
Absolutely.
let's turn the page a little bit. Because what I like to do to help me prepare and get ready for our conversations is to put out a quick APB about who's coming on and if anybody has any questions. So a few things that we've talked about apply to, ignorantly saying general health and wellness. A lot of the individuals that I have the fortunate to work with and my colleagues are in the strength training, Olympic weightlifting, CrossFit fields, and coaches and athletes. Do any of the principles and fundamental skills that we, sorry, you so eloquently articulated before, do they differ in any way in terms of how we apply them to nutrition for sports performance?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
So the fundamental skills are in many ways the fundamental skills. And often why more advanced people are more successful is because they have the strongest foundation already in place, right? Those fundamental skills are second. They know them like the back of their hand. They don't even have to give them a second thought. They just happen automatically, right? So they've become like ingrained in their lifestyle and in their approach. One of my colleagues, Craig Weller, tells a great story of, he had been surfing for like 10 years, but had really been stuck, like self-taught. And so he applied to this surf school, I believe it was in Costa Rica, like the best surf school in the world. And he goes down there and they make him trade in like his fancy board for like a beginner board, right? And so the first day they're working on like the most basic fundamental skills, and he's like, really, man? Like, this is what we're working on? He thought he was gonna be learning like more advanced stuff. He already thought he was, he was past the quote unquote beginner stages. And his coach told him, he's like, look, the best surfers in the world are the best because they have the strongest foundation. They can do crazy tricks and they can do more advanced moves because their balance and their fundamentals are so strong that they don't lose them even when they're doing trickier things. And so that really kind of just stuck with him, right? So it's the same thing for more advanced athletes, right? So they're often the best. Look at someone like Tim Duncan, right? He was called Mr. Fundamental because it's his, but that's one of the reasons why he was so good, because his fundamentals were just rock solid. And then you can start to incorporate fancier things on top of that. So when you look at like nutrient timing or work on nutrition protocols, those things tend to work best when you already have the other fundamentals in place. You could have the greatest nutrient timing in the world, but if you don't have adequate overall protein and calories, right, you're not going to gain muscle mass. So that's where having those fundamentals actually makes those more advanced things work better, because now they can give you that extra edge when rather than just helping you fill your basic needs. So that's where they can really be advantageous. So we kind of put things on like a continuum, right? At PN, we teach coaches to evaluate clients or stratify clients as like level one, level two, or level three. The vast majority of clients are going to end up what you'd call level one, right? So people who are looking just to eat better, move better, live better as a means to do other things in their life. They're not necessarily looking to push the envelope in terms of fitness and nutrition. They don't make money from their bodies. They don't make money from their athletic performance. If you're one of those people who's much more interested in like lifting for the sake of lifting or training for the sake of training, or you get paid to look a certain way or to perform a certain way, well, now some of these other variables, some of these more esoteric approaches or more advanced approaches become more important, right? Because a 3% edge, which didn't matter to your, you know, 9-to-5 worker, matters to you. That's the difference between winning and losing. And so in our mind, it's not like a black and white answer. Too often, I think it's people try to debate nutrient timing does or does not matter. It does or does not matter depending on the context and on the person. So it doesn't really matter for your general population, what we'd call level one clients. It does start to matter for more advanced clients, and it can absolutely matter if you're like, let's say you're competing in a round robin and have four events in a day, or you're competing in an ultra marathon. Well, nutrient timing matters, right? If you're exercising for 4, 5, 6 straight hours, you're going to want to consume something during that activity, right? So there's it's kind of falls on a continuum or a spectrum, but there's definitely value in doing more advanced things for more advanced clients. And it kind of goes back to, I think I mentioned it earlier, making nutrition only as complicated as it needs to be, not as complicated as it can be. Well, as our goals become more complicated, nutrition will have to become more complicated to help reach those goals.
Very well stated. And I'm not going to get into the more advanced, because some of my friends and colleagues did have some of the questions, but I think we got the answers already. And but one thing I do want to ask is, and I think you actually just hit on it a little bit as well, accounting for two-a-days. And you, just, you did mention multiple sessions, but from, let's say I am, hypothetically speaking, not that I am, but yeah, I'm looking to compete in, I don't know, the Olympic weightlifting national championships, and I'm doing 2 days. So as I guess I'm the hypothetical case study, I'm training 2 days. I'm a vegan. What are the most critical aspects of my nutrition, including nutrient timing, you know, carb intake, fats, sugars, that I need to pay attention to?
I mean, honestly, it would depend on you in particular, but as a general rule, like, so what are we looking to emphasize here? We're looking to emphasize performance and recovery. As important as health is in this regard, not that it takes a back seat, but it's less of an emphasis than performance and recovery, right? So we're really kind of emphasizing that. So in terms of nutrient timing, yeah, speed of digestion matters a little bit more here, because you need to have like your glycogen replenished for your next bout of exercise, which might just be in a few hours. Whereas for most other people, you know, if you're exercising every day, you've got like 24 hours to replenish that glycogen between each session. That's not necessarily the case for someone doing 2 a days. So that's where workout nutrition becomes more important. So getting things in that are maybe a little faster digesting, or a little sooner after your workout, or even during workout, depending on the preferences of the individual, the length of your training session. So really start to emphasize elements of recovery and regeneration that go a long way here. So really making sure you're getting in plenty of protein, right? That'd probably be first and foremost, just from a recovery, muscle retention standpoint. And then in terms of like carbs and fats, I would say the research still definitely leans towards carbs being more important, but there is some individual variability, right? You do see some folks thriving on lower carb diets, less so in like the high intensity weightlifting world, because it tends to be more carb demanding, as opposed to like the ultra endurance where you're going for, you know, 20 hours. It's a very different physiological demands. So then I would probably emphasize carbs for performance purposes, for glycogen replenishment purposes, for recovery purposes, right? Lowering cortisol. But you still don't want to overlook fats too, because you need fats for immune health. You need fats for hormone production. So there's kind of an interplay of all of those things there. But I would definitely emphasize protein and carbs particularly around training, whether it's before, during, and or after, or some combination thereof, would somewhat depend on, the timing of your training and the needs of the individual. Those are all things to consider. And fats obviously play a role, but you're not going to be consuming fats so much during activity for GI purposes and stomach distress purposes. But before or after, or just throughout the day, absolutely. So did that kind of actually answer your question, or
It
did I
did.
keep
It
it
did.
too broad?
No, it was perfect because it was a very poorly stated question, and which I have a tendency to do, and I have again the great fortune of an amazing guest that know where my head is at, which doesn't necessarily match what I'm saying. So perfect.
Well, welcome.
thank you. In terms of fats, just this always comes up, and I struggle with this as well. So that's what some of these, obviously, a lot of the questions that I ask is because for my self-education. But in terms of carbs and fats, can you just, I guess, give us a footnote or just a quick summary of good and bad sources of carbs and fats?
Yeah, I mean, I would actually use a different framework.
Okay.
Rather than like good and bad, that kind of black and white, all or nothing mindset. I would, like I said before, we tend to view things on more of a spectrum. And a framework I like to use is eat less often and eat more often, and then somewhere in the middle, eat sometimes or eat often. Right. So kind of like a red, yellow, green. If you want to use like a stoplight
Got
analogy,
it.
any framework you want to use in that regard. So things you want to eat less often. Would obviously be things like trans fats, right? Your hydrogenated oils, and maybe even avoid altogether for the most part. Now, you have it here and there on occasion, no big deal. But keeping that to an absolute minimum, I would also limit things like your industrial seed oils or industrial vegetable oils. So your soybean, your cottonseed, your safflower, your sunflower. There are some exceptions, right? There are high oleic versions of some of those things, like high oleic safflower and high oleic sunflower oil. So those would probably be more towards like have sometimes, in the middle. But other than that, I mean, those are kind of the ones you probably want to really try to limit. In the middle, what other things might be some saturated fats, so like your coconut oil and your butter, you can certainly have them, but the pendulum has swung. A little too far in the other direction, right? We used to demonize saturated fats. Don't eat any butter. Don't eat any tropical oils like coconut or palm. And then some evidence has come out that said, it doesn't seem like saturated fat is really the main driver of all of these health concerns, like cardiovascular disease. But that doesn't mean that you can just eat them until your heart's content. That's not the point of the research, right? So I think people took that and ran with it because it kind of made it easy to be like, oh, if it's not terrible, then it must be awesome. And that's not quite what it was saying. There can still be consequences to excessive consumption. So I'd put stuff like that in the middle. You can certainly have it. You could even have some on a daily basis, but it shouldn't be like the majority of your fat intake. Right. So things that would be eat the most often would be like things like extra virgin olive oil, avocados, things with lots of monounsaturated fats that are consistently shown to be incredibly beneficial, your nuts. Your seeds, in the middle too, it also be something like dark chocolate. Some is good, too much, not so much. So that's kind of how I would view things. It's not an exhaustive list, but it's just kind of giving you that spectrum from, eat sometimes or eat less often to eat some, eat often, and then all the way to the other end, eat the most often, eat more often, eat every day. So and that's kind of how the structure I would use. And people get a little too lost in the weeds of like, oh, I've got to eat this. I can't have that. I can't have butter. I've got to have coconut oil. In the grand scheme of things, long term, how much difference will there be between eating coconut oil and butter? Depending, I mean, I guess the dose matters, but not a whole lot. But making sure you're getting in some extra virgin olive oil or some avocados, some nuts, some seeds, right? Even some peanut butter. Those can be really valuable. Healthy fats, but not getting too tied down or too bogged down in super specific amounts or super specific ratios or this bad and good mindset. And it's the same thing with carbs. Things to eat more of or eat more often would be all fresh fruits, right? All fresh fruits are absolutely game. Your minimally processed whole food versions of things, so potatoes and sweet potatoes, like your starchy tubers, yams. Right, then you've got like your whole grains, so barley, spelt, oats, quinoa, buckwheat, even some whole wheat. If For sure, whole rye. What am I missing? Beans and legumes, right? So any type of bean, lentils, things of that nature would all kind of fall under the eat more often. The eat some of, maybe it'd be like your white rice or white versions of things, white bread. They're not as detrimental as people have made them out to be, but they're not as health providing as the whole versions. Then eat less often would obviously be right straight sugar, right candy, things of that nature. Then it gets a little complicated because some things that we think of as rich sources of carbs are usually a mix of carbs, refined carbs and fats, like your pastries and your donuts, your cakes. Those would all tend to fall under refined carbs, but they're usually relatively rich in fats as well. Potato chips, right? So I mean, generally, it comes down to minimally processed whole food versions are going to usually end up in that eat more often. And then slightly more processed, or some that are maybe or the dose a little more dose dependent in terms of their benefits, like your butter, your coconut oil, your dark chocolate, your white versions of carbs tend to fall somewhere in the middle, and then the really processed stuff tends to fall on the eat less often component.
Beautiful. You had me at chocolate. I forgot about
I actually
that.
just ate some with my coffee before we got in the call.
Perfect. So I forgot everything else. So chocolate's good. Got it.
Blacked out.
moving on. No. So as we kind of close out the conversation, what for you personally, what is the most difficult part of coaching? Most challenging part of coaching?
I think even to this day, the most challenging part is wanting to solve your clients' problems or issues for them, when in reality, what you need to do is help give them the tools to solve them themselves, right? So we want to, clients are kind of expressing a concern with something or a struggle, and we just want to jump in and start offering all kinds of strategies and solutions. And usually that's not what the client's necessarily even seeking, even if they think that's what they're seeking. What they really need is to be validated, to know that these struggles are normal, and then to help them work through it on their own to come up with approaches and strategies that work for them. Now, you can still offer suggestions, but too often I think it's very easy, especially when you think you know the answer, right? To just like you just want to jump up and down and give it to them and shout it at them. And really what you find over and over again when you coach enough people is that fails long term because then they're not actually experimenting and testing and finding what works for them in their own life, in their own particular set of circumstances. And too often we tend to want to jump towards like strategies and tips where it's like, oh, well, if you just cut out, that one roll at dinner or, cut out these French fries here. But that's not teaching like fundamental skills because then if they go to a conference, they go to their mom's house or they go wherever, it might not be fries. They might be presented with different challenges. And then you're not actually giving them tools that are going to help them in various circumstances. So to me, it's still always a challenge for me because I've coached a lot of people, in the neighborhood of 1,000 people or more. And at PN, we've coached nearly 100,000 people as a collective. So, we recognize a lot of the same things that come up over and over again. And so we have a lot of knowledge as to what's probably going to solve this problem for this client. So it can be really easy to just feel like you know the answer or have the answer and you just want to give it to them. But it's the difference between teaching someone how to fish, right, or just giving them a fish. So that's probably still to this day, having that patience to teach them how to fish is the hardest part because sometimes you just feel like, ah, the answer's right there, right? It's right in front of you. And you want them to just grab it. But people figure it out in their own time, in their own way. And so using appropriate questions, giving tips and strategies, but not foisting answers upon people, is hard. It's challenging as a coach. It's much harder than just saying, here's a meal plan, here's what you have to do.
Got it. Now, in terms of the PN certification, is there still a wait list?
Well, I mean, not necessarily a wait list. We just have a pre-sale list, right? So we release it twice a year. So that we can best serve the people who do sign up for it.
Got it.
If we, that's part of the reason why we do it that way is because we're built around launches. That's how we release all of our products, and we time them so that we can, have space between each one so we can best serve the customer care needs or the client needs of people who sign up, right? If we just left it open all year round, it would be much harder for the way we're currently structured to handle that and to deliver the best experience, the best client experience for each person. So, yeah, I mean, it's the signups actually, I think, just ended. Yeah, it just ended end of last week. But I mean, get yourself on the pre-sale list. That gives you the earliest access. You get discounted price when it does launch, and you get, a set of curated emails that kind of give you tons of information about what the cert is and is not, and what it can and can't do for you. So I think there's a lot of value in that approach. I mean, there's value in having a rolling acceptance as well. But it's so I probably wouldn't call it a wait list so much as I would call it a sign up to it for a chance to enroll early and get a discount list.
Yeah, obviously, that was more of a selfish question, and poorly stated again.
It was tongue in cheek. I appreciate it. It was good.
Now, so what is next for you? Any major projects that you're working on? Anything coming up in the future?
Basically, like when I first started at PN, I mean, I've been at PN for about 6 years now. I did a lot of writing, and speaking and coaching, and I've always worn a lot of hats because I've been at PN since we were much smaller than we are today, and so that was just kind of the nature of the beast. And now when we hire people, they're hired for like most larger companies, they're hired for one specific, role or job. That wasn't the case when I started. We held lots of different roles and wore lots of different hats, and I still kind of do to this day. I hadn't done as much writing the past few years, but we've made a conscious effort to shift around some of my work so I can do more writing and more public-facing stuff moving forward here. So I won't necessarily be speaking anymore. I'm pretty tapped out on how much speaking I can do. Well, I mean, podcasts,
No,
not,
yeah,
but
thank you.
presenting and speaking at conferences and seminars and things of that
Wow.
nature. That's what I was getting at. But yeah, definitely going to be doing working on some more projects for the blog. I just submitted an article this morning, and then I'm going to be working on, my goal is to be working on an article about our hand size portions. We get some common questions that come up repeatedly about that. So really kind of maybe further explaining how it works, why it works, the math behind it, how to basically calculate more specific portions for your knees, depending on your activity level and goal and biological sex and weight and things of that nature. This has been like a passion project of mine. So I'm hoping that probably won't be until later this year. That's a big one I'm working on. I've had a metabolism book on my to-do list for like a year and a half, hoping to tackle. So I got quite a few. I got quite a
Okay,
few.
very cool, very cool. And where can folks find you, follow you, if they want more information or just more dose of Brian in their daily lives?
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I would say precisionnutrition.com. Like I said, I will be writing more articles for there so you can see my work. I do have my own site, briansampertraining.com, but I haven't updated that in a long time.
Okay,
And I
I was
don't.
going to
So
ask actually.
there's a static, you can find some older content, lots of older content for sure. But in terms of keeping up with me today, I will freely admit I am not a big social media user. So I have Twitter, but I don't tweet. I have Facebook. I don't use Facebook a whole lot. I don't do Instagram, so I'm not the easiest to find in that regard. But in terms of keeping up with me, I mean, you can look up precisionnutrition.com upcoming seminars, and you can see anywhere that I'm speaking. And then keeping an eye on the blog for, for articles and pieces that I write, for sure.
Very cool. Brian, thank you so much for your time and the education, man. It was a blast.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. This was a great time. I appreciate it.
You got it. Another amazing episode in the books, fam. If you enjoyed the episode, please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play. If you are new to the show, don't be afraid to check out other episodes. And if you dig the content, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. If you ever have any questions, feedback, or you just want to hit us up, please don't hesitate. Email address is contact@unchartedperformance, or you can hit me up directly at powell@unchartedperformance.com. Facebook and Instagram at Uncharted Performance, and if Twitter is your thing, at Reach Uncharted. And give us a follow and tag us to let us know who and where you are. As always, thank you for listening and supporting the podcast, and talk to you next week. Cheers, guys.